From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we're watching that historic flooding in South Carolina. We're going to hear from a city councilor in Columbia in just a few minutes.
But first to what's being called the largest trade deal in modern history. The U.S. and 11 other countries agreed on the Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPP, today. The deal is a big victory for the Obama administration. It includes countries from Canada to Japan and would affect 40% of the global economy. Ali Velshi hosts Ali Velshi on Target on Al Jazeera America. He's with us from New York. And Ali, this deal came together after a long time, lots of negotiating.
Well, it's been a long time. It's been 8 years of negotiations and a year of really intense stuff. What it means is that 12 countries, not including China, all of which in some fashion touch the Pacific, so Canada, the United States, and a lot of Asian countries, countries that make up about 40% of the world's GDP are now entering a trading bloc. It means the elimination of a whole lot of tariffs and duties. In fact, about 1,800 tariffs that collectively the participating countries have placed on the United States will be lifted. So that's going to allow, at least from the White House's perspective, allow for more exports, which is a real target that President Obama wanted to reach, things like autos and machinery and information technology and chemicals. But it's also got labor unions and Democrats in America concerned that it's going to cost jobs, just like these big trade deals tend to do.
And I want to ask you about that. But first, let's talk about some of the sticking points that really got this right down to the wire. There were some around opening up dairy markets in Canada and Japan and protections for drug makers in the U.S. How did it all shake out in the end?
The big thing around drugs was that brand name drug companies wanted to retain rights to their patents for 12 years. Others wanted 5 years to make generic drugs available. So the deal ultimately reached a very complicated compromise. Drug companies get between 5 to 8 years of exclusivity. A lot of environmental concerns as well in this. And you mentioned dairy. Dairy and sugar were two of the biggest concerns, particularly of Americans, that it'll lower the price of sugar and milk. The Canadian side is less complicated because Canada and the U.S. had the free trade agreement and then NAFTA, so there's less to work out on that front. Also, there are concerns about Japan, which has a history of currency fluctuation. Some Democrats will call it currency manipulation, and they feel that the United States has been lax at penalizing Japan for that and even labeling them as currency manipulators. So there are some valid concerns, and there's still some stuff to iron out, but they have reached a deal.
Okay, well, let's talk about what's going to happen now in Congress, because we've already heard from Republican Senator Orrin Hatch, and by and large, Republicans have been on board with this trade deal, but he has threatened now to withdraw support if protections for drug makers were loosened, and today he's saying that the deal seems to fall woefully short. Let's first talk about what's going on the Republican side and opposition there.
So if you've been following the news on how Congress and the president get along, this one's going to surprise you, because while every last Republican voted against the president on the Iran deal, mostly it's Democrats in Congress who don't like this deal and never have. Republicans have generally favored it, but for those few issues that I just mentioned to you, including the pharmaceuticals. The Republicans were in favor of the longer protections for brand-name pharmaceutical companies. Bottom line, though, is that President Obama has a good deal of Republican support on this. If it made it through Congress, it would be legacy defining. It'll be next year that Congress votes on this. For the moment, the betting is that it will get through Congress. They'll figure something out with the Republicans.
Well, and meanwhile, on the Democratic side, we've got the presidential candidate Bernie Sanders tweeting today, "I am disappointed but not surprised by the decision to move forward on the disastrous TPP that will hurt consumers and cost American jobs. Wall Street and other big corporations have won again in the Senate. I will do all that I can to defeat the TPP agreement."
Right. Now, Bernie Sanders has always been against this and generally against these trade deals, which fits fairly squarely into his position on the political spectrum as a Democratic socialist. Labor unions are against it. Donald Trump is against it, too, ironically. Hillary Clinton has supported trade deals traditionally. She supported the TPP talks when she was the Secretary of State. But as she is seeing her support amongst labor unions slip, her official position on TPP is still undecided. So she is not taking a major position. But Bernie Sanders staunchly against it, labor unions staunchly against it.
And obviously, it becomes political when you start getting the presidential candidates involved. But Ali, if you just talk to economists, is there a consensus about whether this is generally good or bad for the economy, or does it kind of depend on who you ask?
Well, it does depend, but here's what I would say would reflect a good survey of economists across the spectrum. Trade deals are good. They're necessary to reduce tariffs to allow people to specialize in what they're good at and sell it to other countries. They do tend to have the effect of lowering labor rates. So for those labor unions who are worried about jobs going overseas or lowering labor prices, it's not an illegitimate concern.
Ali Velshi, host of Ali Velshi on Target on Al Jazeera America, talking with us about the TPP. Thank you so much.
My pleasure, Jeremy.
Well, to South Carolina, where the National Guard is now assisting in search and rescue missions after historic and deadly flooding in the state this weekend. At least 9 people have died, 26,000 statewide don't have electricity, and 40,000 people still don't have water because of broken water mains. South Carolina's Governor Nikki Haley says water distribution sites will be up and running by this evening, and she said 3 hospitals in Columbia, the state capital, that had little or no water because of the flooding will not have to close.
The good news that we have in this is that we have 0 hospitals that are going to have to evacuate. And we have had a lot of heroes, but one in particular are the heroes that work at the Columbia Fire Department. They worked all night long to get the bulk water over to the hospital so that the hospitals didn't have to go down.
Well, joining us now is Columbia City Councilor Tamika Isaac Devine. And Tamika, you say you knew it would be bad, but not this bad. How bad is it?
It is pretty bad. I mean, we were prepared for the worst, and we had a press conference on Thursday to make sure that our citizens were informed and aware, and we gave them tips on how to prepare themselves to be in the house, but we really did not expect the flooding to the levels that it has been. I mean, we have some neighborhoods that are completely underwater. We've had to do water rescues and evacuate people from their homes and apartments via boat, and so it's unlike anything that we've ever experienced before.
Oh, the pictures we're seeing are amazing. We saw a guy in a white pickup drive into high water, and then the next thing you knew, it was a river, and he was carried away, and a man went in swimming to try to rescue him. They both needed to be rescued. Did people not believe it or not take it seriously, or could maybe no one have expected that this is an historic rainfall?
You know, I think it's a little bit of both. I think that people, even who were preparing for it, did not expect that it would be this bad. But I also think that some people just weren't quite expecting or believing it. You know, we thought that the rains would really start hard on Saturday. And Saturday, although we had steady rain throughout the day, we did not have flooding. And so I think people really kind of thought, oh, well, this is another false alarm and we can just go about our business. And then people woke up on Sunday and they didn't necessarily, especially if they lived in an area that outside their immediate house, they didn't see flooding. People left. They went to church, early morning church services, and then saw the flooding and got stuck in their vehicles out on the streets. And so our first responders spent most of yesterday actually rescuing people from cars. And so it was just unbelievable. But I think now people really believe it, but now they're not prepared. And so we've got neighborhoods that are out of water. They don't have electricity. Our biggest university, the University of South Carolina, they're bringing in porta potties. It's just a very surreal situation.
Well, there are so many serious considerations. We saw a man who desperately needed medication for his mother, and a neighbor had a kayak and took him to get it. And he was, you know, in tears because it was a life or death situation. We know your husband went out this morning, and he works for a housing nonprofit. Can he get to his low income and elderly clients?
He has not been able to get to all of them. He has been able to at least via telephone confirm that people are okay. But as he's gone to try and check on a lot of his residences, he's found that roads are blocked off. We've got sinkholes that have come in some of the roads. And so there are neighborhoods that are really cut off from the mainstream. And so he's been unable to actually physically go and check on some people. It's a amazing situation that I don't think that for the depth of what we're seeing that we were really expecting it to be this bad.
Well, you're chair of the Environment and Infrastructure Committee, so you're going to be front row on some of those issues. But I just briefly before we let you go, I know people are cut off, maybe not talking as much as they would normally, but yours is a city that also was recently battered by that church shooting in which so many were killed inside a church. I'm just wondering how, you know, this is a lot for one place.
Yeah, but I think one thing that we learned definitely through this summer and everything that we went through with the church shooting and understanding everything that we were having to deal with moving forward is that we're a very resilient community and that people here are very caring and giving. I mean, although we've been encouraging people to stay in and we're still encouraging people to do that, we're getting inundated with calls and emails from people saying, what can I do? I know that people are stranded. I know people don't have water. What can we do? And so we're very confident that we'll be able to address the immediate needs of our citizens and then be able to plan long-term to get back to where we need to be.
That's Tamika Isaac-Devine, city councilor in Columbia, South Carolina. Best to you.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure.
This weekend, I asked NPR's legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg for her opinion on something in the news. She refused.
Because my opinion's no better than anybody else's opinion. You can make your own judgment about that.
It's just us.
Us and over 800 New Hampshire Public Radio listeners who packed the Capital Center for the Arts in Concord for an event sponsored by Constitutionally Speaking. That's a consortium of groups trying to galvanize dialogue about civics. Nina Totenberg needs no prodding. She touched on things like the recent recovery of her father Roman's stolen Stradivarius. The rallying cry now for conservative Republicans. She says it's no more Souters, Souter being the moderate former justice from New Hampshire, David Souter, who was in the audience. Then there was the story of Justice Ginsburg falling asleep during the president's State of the Union. She told Nina it was because lawmakers can jump up and down.
And she said, and then she said, but we sit there sober as judges. And then she said, except that, of course, I wasn't entirely sober.
But with the Supreme Court's new session starting today, we started by talking about what it might face. Here are some excerpts.
Can anything match June of last year and all the cases of the last session?
Probably not.
Yeah.
You know, there are few times when there's that kind of thunderous opinion as same-sex marriage, much less Obamacare II and some other important decisions. So probably you could count on two hands the numbers of opinions since 1965 or something like that that are of that importance and that everybody understands from the very beginning are of that importance. So probably not, but there are one or two cases, really one case this term, that could end up being that important, though I doubt it.
Well, let's start with that.
So the court has not yet accepted this case for review, but it's sitting there waiting in the wings, and I think it probably will. And it's a test of the Texas abortion statute, which has been copied by other states. So it's significant in the sense that it's not just Texas, it's other states as well. And abortion clinics have to follow the same structural rules as a hospital, basically. And that's extremely costly and would automatically cut the number of abortion clinics in the state by well over a half.
And in Texas in particular, it also is impossible in some areas because it's so rural.
No, yes, and it's a huge state.
Yeah.
So women would have to travel, in some cases, up to 300 miles round trip. The lower court upheld it, saying only some 900,000 women might possibly face that trip. But but the point is that the court has said there can't be an undue burden on the right to have an abortion. So, and then the other thing is those who perform abortions have to have privileges at a hospital within 30 miles. And given the politics of abortion politics these days, that is often impossible. They import people to be doctors at these clinics. So if those kinds of restrictions, and there are more, are upheld, I think it's fair to say, while abortions would be relatively easy to obtain in some other states, they would not be in probably half the country or more.
Where do you think it's going to go?
It's hard to know. Justice Kennedy has supported the right to an abortion, but has rarely, almost ever, been willing to strike down restrictions on the right to abortion. So at some point, the so-called undue burden test could become pretty meaningless, because if all you have to have is a rational basis for enacting these kinds of restrictions, and that is the lowest threshold, then Roe versus Wade is, for all practical purposes, eliminated. You may not say we're reversing Roe versus Wade today, but that's, in point of fact, what's happening.
All right, so we'll keep an eye on that case. I was interested in the death penalty cases.
Well, there are a whole bunch of them this year, but none of them addresses the question that Justice Breyer raised at the end of last term. He said he thought it was time to revisit the question of whether the death penalty is cruel and unusual punishment.
This was in the Glasso case considering lethal injections.
Then he raised a bunch of issues not really related to lethal injections, but he pointed to studies that show not just that there are racial disparities in the way it's administered, but serious geographical disparities. When you have those sort of disparities, the question he raised is that constitutional? And then he raised a bunch of other questions about whether you can actually say that it's a deterrent when it's so rarely used, and most importantly, the question of the number of people who have been on death row who are subsequently proved innocent through DNA testing. And I think there's probably a lot of work to be done yet to prove some of these points to a better certainty. He, after all, suggested only that the time had come for the court to reconsider the question. And I don't expect the court is going to reconsider the question anytime soon. But I expect those who oppose the death penalty will seek to have some empirical data that doesn't exist today on the question. I'm going to tell you about one or two cases that are not involving the death penalty. There's a very important labor case for, oh, I don't know, 40 years or so. It was 1977 that the Supreme Court ruled that if a majority of workers in the public sector decide to be represented by a union, other public employees within that group of people do not have to join the union. They don't have to pay for the political activities of the union, but they do have to pay their fair share of the bargaining costs because they benefit from the contract that is subsequently negotiated. And a great many states have laws that say when there's a union bargaining agreement, it applies to everyone, that you can't negotiate for half the people there and not for the other half of the people. So since they benefit from the contract that's struck, they have to pay their fair share of the bargaining costs. And there are clearly four justices who think it is time to reverse this. And the fifth justice, who in the past has supported the idea of fair share payments, is Justice Scalia. And so if he does what it looks like he's going to do, which is side with his fellow conservatives on this question and say this is a violation of the non-members' First Amendment rights because anything that a union does is a political subject of debate, therefore, the non-members shouldn't have to pay for it. If that is the case and the court reverses the case called Abood from 1977, it will seriously hobble public employee unions and potentially, ultimately, other unions. So for unions, this is pretty much a last stand legal argument, and they will be seriously hobbled if they lose this one. And there's quite a serious reason to think they will lose this one.
I want to get your thoughts, Nina, on how the Constitution has been spoken of in the presidential race. Ted Cruz says that he will amend it to end birthright citizenship. Now, Donald Trump is against birthright citizenship, the idea of someone is born here, even to parents who are not citizens, they have a birthright. But he says, you know, it would take way too long to change it. So let's just say that it doesn't mean people who were born to people who are children of undocumented immigrants. Let's just say that it doesn't mean them. As you're listening to the Constitution invoked this way, your thoughts?
Robin, that's not fair. I did a piece talking about the way that the various candidates talked about not just the Supreme Court, but John Roberts, the Chief Justice. And, you know, John Roberts has a very conservative record. He was a dissenter in the same-sex marriage cases. He has voted against any racial preferences, against affirmative action. He wrote the opinion striking down the key provision of the Voting Rights Act. He has consistently voted to strike down regulations governing campaign spending. And so There's only one subject on which he has cast a vote that conservatives don't like, and that's Obamacare. Everybody was talking about him during that second debate. You would have thought he was a liberal like William O. Douglas. I mean, it was sort of bizarre for anybody who knows anything about the court.
Much was made of Republicans when those cases came out, saying, well, it's just the Supreme Court. I mean, why is the Supreme Court getting to judge, things like health care?
Somebody has to. That's the way
that's
the Constitution is written.
Right. But Hillary Clinton has come out and said that she wants to push for an amendment to, in effect, overturn the 2010 Citizens United decision. But isn't that the same? You know, isn't that someone saying the court was wrong?
Lots of times people say the court was wrong, and if you're lucky, it's not a constitutional ruling, it's a statutory ruling, and you can get Congress to go back and change the law. But if the decision is based on the Constitution, then the only way to change it is by a constitutional amendment. And there's nothing wrong with trying to have a constitutional amendment, except that all those of you folks who clapped that she favored a constitutional amendment, I defy you to sit down and try to write something about the First Amendment that would change it in a way that would not open a door to something you would really hate a lot.
Thank you so much, Nina Totenberg.
Thank you all.
Just a week ago, the conventional wisdom in Washington was that Majority Leader Kevin McCarthy of California would replace House Speaker John Boehner when he steps down as Speaker of the House this month. But after McCarthy made some controversial comments, it opened the door for other hopefuls. And yesterday, Utah Congressman Jason Chaffetz threw his hat in the ring. Here he is on Fox News Sunday.
Today, here, I am announcing my intention to run for Speaker of the House of Representatives. We were entrusted by the American people with the largest majority the Republicans have ever had since Babe Ruth was swinging the baseball bat. But they didn't send us here to perpetuate the status quo.
Joining us now is NPR lead political editor Domenico Montanaro. And Domenico, this looks like it's turning into a real race.
It is. I think the thing to watch, though, is who comes out in support of Jason Chaffetz as opposed to Kevin McCarthy. This is all behind closed doors. And while right now it looks like McCarthy is certainly still the overwhelming favorite, we shouldn't make any kinds of predictions because leadership races can often have an air of unpredictability as things get closer.
Well, tell us a little bit more about Jason Chaffetz.
Well, he's an interesting guy, from Utah, a congressman from Utah. He was elected in 2008. This is somebody who has a kind of interesting background. He's lined up with the Tea Party, and especially on data privacy issues. He's had an outspoken reputation in Congress. He gained some attention last week with his treatment of the Planned Parenthood hearing. This is somebody, though, who his father was a chairman of Michael Dukakis's presidential campaign in Utah back in 1988. So he had some Democratic roots, actually. He was actually recruited as a place kicker to play football on the BYU football team. Kind of a diverse background. You might remember John Huntsman, who was the governor of Utah. Chaffetz was actually his chief of staff and ran his campaigns. So it's interesting that he's somebody who has always kind of been involved in the campaign political infrastructure of things. And, he's not somebody who shies away from power and wanting to be in control and in charge. But it's interesting he comes at it from that strategic point of view as an operative, somebody who has his roots as being an operative and maybe sees an opening here with Kevin McCarthy, maybe looking potentially a little vulnerable.
Well, and the reason that he's looking vulnerable, I guess we should say right now, let's play the tape, is because he was out there last week saying that the special committee created to investigate the Benghazi attacks was created to make political gain against Hillary Clinton. Let's listen.
Everybody thought Hillary Clinton was unbeatable, right? But we put together a Benghazi special committee. What are her numbers today? Her numbers are dropping. Why? Because she's untrustable. But no one would have known any of that had happened had we not thought and made that happen.
So, Domenico, I just want to back up briefly here. Is this a sign of a bigger rift in the Republican Party?
Well, it certainly is. I mean, we've been talking about this for some time, that John Boehner was ousted in a way because of this motion to vacate that some people in the party had come up with to try to get Boehner out and have a vote essentially of no confidence. The fact is here, though, we have to watch how many people do go against McCarthy. If that's the case, he can only lose probably 30 people without having a chance to win this thing.
Domenico Montanaro, NPR's lead political editor, joining us from Washington. Thank you.
Thank you.
This podcast is sponsored by Casper. Casper is an online retailer of premium mattresses made in America. They're engineered for comfort and long-lasting support by combining premium latex foam and memory foam. It's outrageous comfort at a polite price. Here's the great part. Pick the one that is best for you and try it out risk-free for 100 days with free delivery and returns. Go to Casper.com/now and you can save $50. That's Casper.com/now.
The other day, I was at the gym and one of the employees told me about an interesting dilemma. Some new customers stopped in recently, and although the staff thought they were women, they said they identified as men and wanted to use the men's locker room. The staff obliged, but customers complained. Turns out this has happened before. Earlier this year, Planet Fitness canceled a Michigan woman's membership after she complained that a transgender woman's presence in the locker room made her feel unsafe. She's now suing the company. Joining us now are Hilda Lindemann and Jamie Nelson. They both teach bioethics at Michigan State University. They are also partnered, and Jamie is transgender. Professors, welcome to both of you.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
Well, what do you make of this dilemma, or is it a dilemma at all? The idea that somebody who comes into a gym says, I identify as a male or I identify as a female, I'd like to use that locker room, and then other customers may be upset by it.
Well, one of the things that strikes me about that is that it's always bathrooms and locker rooms, especially when it comes to trans stuff. And it seems that people get uncomfortable when they are around bodies that aren't shaped like theirs. But you wouldn't allow people to not use a bathroom or a locker room if they were disabled. You wouldn't allow it, people to ban them because they're uncomfortable being around people of another race. And so I wish people would just chill on this a little bit.
It has something to do with the basic terms of the way we relate to each other in a society. I mean, if you say to trans people that basically you're not welcome here, that's a way of limiting their access to the world, and it's a way of limiting or it's a way of saying to them that you really don't count as people. You really don't count as equal individuals. You're not going to be allowed to interact with others on terms of equality. And we've got really bad precedents for that in history. I don't think we want to go down that road anymore.
Well, let me ask you about this, though, because if that's the case, and if all businesses in this way are supposed to say, okay, fine, whatever the person says that they identify as, they should be able to use that locker room or that bathroom, couldn't that be abused? Couldn't somebody just come in and say, I want to go into the women's locker room, I'm just going to say I identify as female, and what are they going to say to me? They can't tell me no.
Well, that wouldn't have to be a problem. Right now, the privilege of I've identified as a woman all my life, and I've used plenty of bathrooms, and it's always possible that there's somebody in there who wants to take a look at something. But we just accept that people are weird sometimes. I don't think this has to be any stranger than what we already have. The other point I want to make here, though, too, is that people need uptake from other people when they are trying to express who they take themselves to be. We all have self-concepts, but we can't really act on them properly or navigate our social worlds with them unless other people cooperate. There's really no reason here why other people can't cooperate.
Jamie, what about you? How do you feel about that?
Well, I mean, I think Hilda's right. There's all kinds of ways in which we can menace each other in principle, but I don't think we build our society around the possibility that someone might take advantage of the way in which we accommodate each other. There's very little evidence that anyone actually has been harmed in these ways. This remains hypothetical. And so long as it remains hypothetical, I think there's really no reason not to recognize the equal personhood of people who are trans. I mean, I don't think we want to preclude the possibility that people can change who they are, that people can live in ways that seem more satisfying to them, more richly, rich ways of expressing who they are.
And you're saying if somebody's uncomfortable with that, that's their problem.
Well, I don't want to be that sounds harsh to me. I want to acknowledge the fact that in any time of change and upheaval in social relations, there are always going to be people whose feelings get out of joint on the basis of it. I mean, basically, any change of this kind in society really is a change for everybody. It's not just for people who identify as trans, but for all people. We have to think about gender in new ways. And I think we have to be accommodating and understanding, but fundamentally, I think it's education. It's not. It shouldn't be a legal matter. It shouldn't be a matter of trying to assert some way of basically turning the clock back and moving in a retrograde direction.
I grew up in Georgia in the 1950s, and I well remember the signs in my doctor's waiting room. There was one waiting room for white people and one for black people. Had black people gone into the white people's waiting room at that time, they would have been intensely discomforted, maybe sued the doctor. We all had to learn to get along. We had to learn that the color of your skin is irrelevant to what kind of care you're going to get in the doctor's office, and that black people don't menace white people. If anything, it's the other way around. This seems to me that same kind of social upheaval, as was the upheaval when women first got the vote. We had to rethink woman. Then we had to rethink blacks. Now we're rethinking gay and lesbian, and we're rethinking trans, and I think that's all good.
Jamie, I want to ask you about your personal experience with this. First of all, when did you first identify as a woman?
Well, that's an interesting question. I suppose one might say when I was 3, except it probably wouldn't have been a woman at that point. But I've been living as a woman for about 2 years now.
2 years. And at what point during that time did you start to use the women's restroom? And did you ever have a problem, or women's locker room? Did you ever have a problem doing that? Did anybody ever raise an eyebrow?
About 2 years ago, and no, I've been lucky in that respect. I think there might be something to a practical advantage to transitioning when you're of an advanced age. You're less likely to attract attention of any kind.
So do you think we should be moving in the direction of bathrooms that anyone can use, that really it doesn't matter if it's a men's or a women's or a locker room for that matter, that we just stop worrying about which gender goes into which room?
I wouldn't object to that. I think, for one thing, that happens in Europe a fair amount, doesn't it, Hilda? I mean,
yeah, and it happens in our homes, too. It doesn't have to be a big deal.
Hmm. So why do you think we haven't gotten there?
Because we care a lot about gender. We get awfully uncomfortable if we can't read somebody's gender. It drives us crazy. We need to know. We need to be able to classify that way. I'm not quite so sure why that is, but at least in our society and in European societies, there are only two genders. And this is why people get especially uncomfortable around transgender people if they can't tell for sure that they are clearly one or the other gender. That it would be great if we could stop that.
Well, I'm wondering if you have somebody who is trans who says, I now identify as a man, I'd like to use the men's locker room. And then let's say you have somebody in the locker room who has some sort of religious objection to being naked in the company of somebody of the opposite sex, or at least the opposite anatomy. What do you do then?
Well, reasonable accommodations, I think, in that case. I mean, religious objections in principle can range over anything, right? I mean, someone could say, well, I object to being in the same room with a non-circumcised man or something like that. I think we do the best we can to accommodate these conscientious beliefs, but not in ways that fundamentally restrict the ability of people to live on terms of equality with other people. I think that's got to be the fundamental touchstone for us.
I think of this in terms of a story I heard a couple of years ago about a man who was an Orthodox Jew, and he got on a plane, and it turned out there was a woman sitting beside him, and he demanded that she get up and move because he was not allowed to sit next to a woman. It seemed like in that case, what he was doing was infringing on her freedom to be where she had paid for this ticket. But certainly accommodations can be made. And I think in in the case I'm thinking about, what they did was reseat the man, the Orthodox Jew, in a role where there were only men. We do this a lot, especially in a country where the state isn't supposed to impose religion. We have been fairly tolerant sometimes about other people's religions, and I think that could be done here as well.
Jamie, of all the issues that trans people have to deal with, is this one of the big ones, or is this not even on the radar?
I don't think this is one of the big ones. No, though. I mean, yeah, I don't want to minimize it too much. I mean, for example, bathroom access to public accommodations is a very important issue because it has to do with one's ability to move freely in the world. I mean, access to private gyms, I think, is probably a more limited, sort of a class limited matter. And I think a lot of trans people are facing not questions about how they're going to afford a gym membership, but how they're going to afford simply a roof over their heads.
That's Jamie Nelson and Hilda Lindemann, both professors of bioethics at Michigan State University. Thanks to both of you for joining us.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
3 years ago, the band Churches was unknown, but oh, that internet. A few songs go viral and boom. Churches' debut album got rave reviews. They played more than 350 shows in 2 years. And now a new album and a new single. Whenever I feel it coming on, you can be well aware. If ever I try to push away, you can just keep me. Tell me you'll meet me. Tell me you'll keep me. Tell me you'll meet me. We meet me more than halfway up. The song is Clearest Blue. The album called Every Open Eye came out late last month. Here now's Miles Parks spoke with the three musicians in Churches about the release before a show in Washington and has this story.
My brother Tyler introduced me to Churches 2 summers ago. He told me they were infectious. I'll come clean. Everyone knows it's me. The musicians got together in Glasgow, Scotland 3 years ago. They blew up almost immediately after their first album was released. By last summer, they were playing late slots across the summer festival lineup. Bonnaroo, Coachella, Lollapalooza. Larry Fitzmaurice, a music writer with Vice, reviewed the band's first album in 2013. He said they're what a generation raised on electronic music is looking for in a rock band.
There's a real yearning to feel something, just to reach out and like get an electric shock, no matter where it's coming from. And I think Churches are one of a few bands that are really providing that in a really emotionally satisfying way.
To thank my brother for turning me on to Churches, I let him meet the band and grab a photo before I interviewed them on their tour bus.
This is Tyler.
Hi, how's it going?
Hi, nice to meet you guys.
How you doing, mate?
Big fan. All right, 1, 2, 3.
It's his new profile picture on Facebook, obviously. In the corner of the photo, but in the foreground, is their lead singer, Lauren Mayberry. She's the youngest of the three at 26. Early on, critics said the band's biggest weakness was its live show. But Mayberry says because of their quick rise, they almost had to use their shows to experiment.
As much as we never did anything that we felt we weren't ready for, we did do an awful lot of stuff in a short space of time. So I think just getting on the road and touring consistently for two and a bit years was very helpful to us in terms of figuring out what we wanted the band to be live. And to me, I would rather have it happen like that naturally, like a natural evolution, rather than being like, okay, we need to write this kind of album or we need to be these kind of performers because that's what people think you should be. I don't think that feels very... It's no point in forcing yourself to be something you're not, I guess.
During their live set, Mayberry takes center stage. She's flanked on both sides by the other two members, Martin Doherty and Ian Cook, who mostly play synthesizers and keyboards. They were a supporting headliner at this year's Pitchfork Music Festival. Church's popularity has exponentially increased even in just the past year. The band's most popular song has more than 30 million plays on Spotify. Even though the band is just a few years old, Martin Doherty has been a professional musician for almost his entire adult life. He says he doesn't understand it when some bands say they long for the days of writing and performing music without the world watching.
I invite those guys to live in the back of a van over 7 American tours. Feel like every day you're pushing a rock up a hill, and when you get to the show that you've driven 8 hours to get to, there's 17 people there. I don't feel particularly nostalgic for those days.
Why? I don't understand.
No. What we have now is everything that I've ever wanted in the music business, you know?
That was Ian Cook chiming in there. He's the oldest of the trio at 40, and he says the band's differing ages and musical influences help shape their sound. There's some Peter Gabriel,
early Madonna,
The Eurythmics,
Depeche Mode, Prince, Michael Jackson.
Cook, Doherty, and Mayberry used all of those influences in making this second album, called Every Open Eye. They spent almost 6 straight months holed up in their basement studio in Glasgow. The record came out late last month, and it's gotten almost universal praise.
As much as it's got some of the darkest stuff we've written, I think it also has some of the most hopeful, forward-facing stuff. And I like that it can kind of draw a line under where we are and just look forward.
For now, Mayberry and her bandmates acknowledge that future is on the road. The three kicked off their North American tour at Landmark Music Festival in Washington, D.C. A notable music blog, Consequence of Sound, called theirs the best set of the weekend. Mayberry stomped and kicked, while Cook and Doherty bobbed next to her surrounded by electronic instruments. Thousands of fans screamed the singer's lyrics back at her. Of course, my brother Tyler was among them, jumping up and down in the front row, taking pictures the whole time. For Here and Now and NPR News, I'm Miles Parks.
Lucky brother to get his brother to do that story. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.